weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to Beta De Silva for driving us through the afternoon. It is Friday, July 12th. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On, an international football soccer special with you all the way until 10 o'clock tonight, and we have lots to get through between now and then. Adrian Eames is alongside Mary Curtin for live match commentary as the Republic of Ireland women's national team take on England in their Euro 2025 qualifier at Carrow Road. Tony O'Donoghue will be dialing in from Norwich while Alan Colley joins Maeve the Burke for expert analysis here in studio. We'll also keep an eye on all of the League of Ireland matches this evening and reflect on a night of mixed fortunes for Irish clubs in Europe. Speaking of Europe, Fergal Brennan will join the football conversation to preview Sunday's Euro 2024 final between Spain and England. We have a couple of Gaelic football heavyweight clashes to look forward to as well. Austin O'Malley is here to preview the All-Ireland football semi-finals and the Tailteann Cup final. Bernard Jackman has his say in Ireland's second test in South Africa. Jane Mangan chats racing and Shane Stokes brings us up to date with the Tour de France. As always, if you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552 or contact us on WhatsApp 087 187 9200.
Game on 2FM.
Good evening. Welcome along to the show. Welcome along to 4 hours of sport with you all the way until 10 o'clock. Austin O'Malley and Alan Collier in studio. Tony O'Donoghue, who's in Norwich, will be going to him very shortly. Austin O'Malley, how are you? Looking forward to it?
Yeah.
Big weekend of Gaelic football?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's going to be a cracker just looking at the couple of games and obviously the Tailteann Cup as well. And as we said, I suppose a little bit of a novelty weekend when, you know, not having Dublin at the table as part of the conversation.
Okay, okay. Don't have to rub it in.
Yeah, well, needs mentioning now and again, you know.
Give it to him, Austin.
Give it from
to
left, right and centre. There you go now.
Been ganged up here by ye Westerners.
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
Evening, Shane. How are you?
Alan, I'm very well. I'm very well after a resplendent evening in Talca Park.
I can see the smile on your face.
He's
right
beaming,
there.
Isn't he?
Some of my favourite words, 4 hours of sport.
Yes.
They're four of my favourite words, to be honest with you. But yeah, you are smiling, Shane. Rightly so. Good result. Good night. Mm.
Mixed fortunes, though, for League of Ireland.
Well, humbling defeat, I would say, for Derry City.
Yeah.
Disappointed with that.
Can we blame the heat?
It's definitely a factor.
Mm.
It's definitely a factor because even I heard Damien Duff speaking about it today in preparation for them going away next week. So it is a factor. I have experience of playing over in Malta in red hot heat as well on an AstroTurf, and it wasn't the nicest experience, I must say. More the humidity than anything else, Shane. Mm. It's tough to breathe. So it's definitely a factor, but still, to be losing 2-0, one of those goals, the set piece as well, I don't think that's a factor in the heat. Obviously, that's a lack of concentration and switching off.
Wait, but could you blame the heat? I'm not, I ask this sincerely, but even from a performance coach point of view?
Well, I suppose there are studies linked to hydration. When you lose certain, you know, in terms of hydration, if players become dehydrated, it can affect certainly concentration levels and that. There's research on that in terms of, but I don't know if Alan's going to buy that.
Well, no, look, I listen to the science.
But sometimes I think
we can be too quick to jump to excuses, and us going away to a team in Gibraltar, like, if we've aspirations to improve things and move the league on in the direction that we wanted to move on, we should be beating a team from Gibraltar, it would be my view. Now, they obviously have the chance to put things right next week, Derry, but 2-0 is it's an uphill task for them, no matter who you're playing against.
For Shelburne, 2-1 wasn't a great performance, I think, by either of the teams. It was a cracking atmosphere in Talca Park, and I genuinely say that objectively. But Shells weren't at their best. Josephs didn't look like they were up to much. The chance from the crowd was they were just a poor Stella Maris, with respect to Stella Maris.
What a chant.
I think it was just a similar colour scheme, that was all. Yeah. But as you mentioned, it is a case of if we want to progress the league, and you look at the coefficient, Mark Langdon was on during the week as well, and he's a big fan of the coefficient, looking at that, and we were talking about Rovers in Iceland, about how the Irish League would be ahead of the Icelandic League and would certainly be ahead of the Gibraltar League as well, that we should be aiming for victories and good performances as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was important for Shells just to get the victory on the night, I suppose, because it was a big occasion. There was a lot of talk pre-match about the fact that they haven't been in Europe in 18 years. It looked brilliant, to be fair. The scenes, some of those players never played in Europe as well, so it might be a case, Shane, that there was a bit of nerves and apprehension, obviously, which is understandable in such a big game. So it's important that they got the victory, which they did. They can obviously go away from home and build on that, I suppose, and get themselves into the next round. But just, I would actually, And I don't know if it's gone a bit too deep too early after just one game, but I think those results last night are more a reflection, and even Shamrock Rovers, of where the league is at the moment, Shane. I don't think the quality of the League of Ireland Premier Division is anywhere near I suppose the standards that we would expect it to be in terms of going away and progressing in Europe and going through 3, 4, 5 rounds or getting to a group stage. I think the league at the moment, definitely the standard has dipped. That's not taken away from anything that Shelburne have done, but I certainly think
dipped compared to what?
Compared to maybe where it was few years back. Definitely, I would think it has dipped. And I think it's more reflective of the league in general in terms of it's become more, there's a lot of young lads, lots of opportunities for lads going away. There's our best talent gets taken away fairly quickly mid-season, if you like. Even there was a big talent drip there, was it last summer, the likes of Dawson Devoy, Ross Tierney, all these lads, Mandriau, like there was a lot of talent taken out of the league in one kind of whoosh. You look at Shamrock Rovers, who was obviously have been the standard bearers over the last 3 or 4 years, the lack of progression from them in Europe, and you look at where they're at in the league this year and the drop off from them as well. Again, as I said, it's nothing to take away from Shelburne. They're for me on the rise and on the up, but certainly just in general across the league, I think the standard has dropped off. I'm at matches every week, Shane. The eyes don't lie as well, and in some ways it's a negative, and in other ways, as I say, it's a positive, because there's so much opportunities for young lads now coming into the league, which is a good thing in terms of trying to develop young talent. But just the league as a whole, I just think it has dropped off.
No, that's a fair point. We bring Tony O'Donoghue into the conversation, and we will be chatting to Tony about England Ireland, of course, our feature this evening. But Tony, just following up on that League of Ireland point that Alan was making, do you feel it is dipping somewhat?
I guess results are what matters in all sport, really, isn't it? And if the results in Europe don't go well, the coefficient is affected, and those are the cold hard statistics. I'd love to know how, like, the Shelburne team of 18 years ago, the last time they were in Europe, would compare with the team now, because we do hear of players being, you know, better nutrition, better strength and conditioning, better tactical awareness. Younger, you'd want to expect that the standard should be better. But I feel we're losing a lot of the individual players, some of the street ballers, as John Jones said, or Eamon Dunphy. You know, so somebody, there's more systems now, and there's less individuality. That's one thing I feel I've noticed in the game, and it's a pity, because, you know, the sort of things that Richie Towell was doing, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, you don't do that so often anymore. That's the sort of observation I'd have on it. But look, we've got the second legs to come, and results will tell us all.
Very much so. Hopefully Shells can continue in the right manner, and Derry can turn it around, and Rovers, of course, nil all. They welcome Víkingur to Tala next week. But Tony, you are in Norwich, sold out Carrow Road, I believe, for this evening. What's the atmosphere like?
Well, can we blame rain if the performance is not so good? Like, we're blaming the sun in Gibraltar. Rain is pouring down. That normally actually helps the game. The pitch looks absolutely wonderful, I'd have to say. And the rain falling will only kind of help the ball zip along. But Ireland might be a little bit concerned about that as well, because they're up against a star-studded England team. Who'll be blind James, the Chelsea player who's injured. But other than that, they have a selection dilemma as to who to put in goal. Does Mary Earps come back in, or will Hannah Hampton continue? For Ireland, well, we're missing our star player in Katie McCabe. She unfortunately received a second yellow card and is suspended for this game. She will be back for the game next Tuesday against France in Parky Cueve in Cork. We're also missing Ciara Caruso, probably our most improved forward, certainly our most prolific in the Nations League, but of course we haven't scored a goal yet in this league. Jamie Finn missing as well, Heather Payne missing. So Eileen Gleeson has...
Tony, I think some of that rain might be affecting your line there, so we will say thank you for the moment, and we will be having live coverage of England Ireland in Carrow Road a bit later on. Alan, you're sticking around. Mate, the Burke will be joining us, Adrian Eames and Mary Curtin on commentary for that. It's going to be a tough task for the girls in green this evening, Alan.
Yeah, absolutely, Shane. Obviously they're missing Katie as well, which is going to make it even harder. Ciara Caruso, it looks like she's not going to play. So they're two massive blows, and I suppose we don't have the squad that maybe the England and the better teams have, that we can afford to be losing our better players. So it's going to be a massive challenge for the girls. Hopefully they can rise to the challenge. They've steadily been progressing, I would say, through this group in what's a really difficult group. France, Sweden, England, we knew that from the outset. And they've been steadily progressing in terms of putting maybe spells together in the games rather than actually, I think Eileen spoke about maybe a 45-minute performance in a couple of the games, but we've yet to see a 90-minute performance. And there's been spells, as I said, throughout those games where they have put the teams under pressure. They haven't scored a goal yet, Shane, so it'd be great to maybe score a goal as well. And I don't want to sound too defeatist, but we're a good bit off the elite level in terms of France, Sweden, England, and this has been a bit of an eye-opener for the girls. Obviously, there was a lot of I suppose euphoria after the World Cup and where they felt the team was at, but certainly going into a group like this against the best teams in the world, it's certainly been an eye-opener in terms of the gap and the bridge that we still have to kind of get over if we're to even compete at this level.
I think very fair to say that we must have realistic expectations going into this evening's match in particular, given the magnitude of the test, because England as well, it's not like they've already qualified ranking. They're still gunning for points here. They still need a result.
Yeah, and I think that's what tells you about the group as well, Shane, in the sense that France, Sweden, England, they've all beaten each other. So I think France is on 9 points and the other two are on 7. So England still have plenty to play for, as you say, because they're not fully qualified. So it's going to be a big ask. Full crowd as well, obviously. Sellout stadium in Carr Road would be a great experience for the girls as well. Lovely stadium to play in as well. So that'd be a great experience, and they're well used to that as well now, so that shouldn't faze them either, Shane, you know, playing in big stadiums like that. So hopefully, as I say, they can rise to the occasion, but it's a big ask against what I would think would be one of the best in the world. England are a phenomenal team, they really are, with unbelievable individual talent. Even though Lauren James isn't playing, they've the depth of squad that they have all over, even the substitutions, the squad, like, it's they're operating at a serious level compared to what we are.
Well, a big night for the English women's team, and hopefully a positive night for the Irish women's team this evening in Norwich. Speaking of English football, the England men's team are preparing for Euro final this Sunday against Spain. Fergal Brennan joins the conversation now to preview that one. Fergal, if I come to you first, are we going to see a good match on Sunday? It seems to be my generic go-to question every time in this Euros, because it's slowly kind of getting there, and hopefully it will now come to a crescendo with a proper final. Or will it be one of these stereotypical finals where it's going to be all edgy, all cagey, and maybe not a classic?
I think it'll be an exciting game. I think finals, or the dynamics of finals, have changed ever so slightly in the last few years. You think of the World Cup final in 2022 with France and Argentina, and even the Euros final between Italy and England went all the way through extra time, penalties. It was exciting. It wasn't just a 1-0 and a team sitting on it for a substantial amount of the game. And I think when you look at the respective runs to the final for Spain and for England, Spain have been excellent. You know, we've talked about this many times. They've been the team of the tournament. They've won all six games. They've only needed extra time once. They haven't needed penalties. And they've impressed. And when they've come up against really top-level sides, teams that they will be expected to kind of go toe-to-toe with, France and Germany, they've come out on top. I think England, as the knockouts have gone on, have made small improvements, not significant major improvements, small improvements. And generally, the level of team that they've played has increased as they've gone through. If you go from Slovakia to Switzerland to the Netherlands, but Spain have done big steps. They've gone from Georgia to Germany to France, and they've passed every test without missing a beat. Whereas with England, each game from the group stages all the way through, there's been an asterisk next to them.
Yeah, on that point, Alan, for Spain, I mean, winning six matches without requiring penalties, as Fergal mentioned, beating Croatia, Italy, Germany, France, albeit now it's not the best Italian team that we've seen in recent years, but they've scored the most goals, they've created the most chances, they have a young talent like Lamine Yamal, they have all the balance. Is there any reason why Spain won't win this final?
Well, I said to you on Wednesday, was it, Shane, when we were discussing this, that if there's any justice whatsoever in the footballing world, yeah, Spain will win this because of the form, all the reasons, as you pointed to there, in terms of the goals they've scored, chances created, the football that they've played. They've won the six matches, so they're in red hot form. So if there is any justice, they will win. But football doesn't work like that, Shane, unfortunately.
I was hoping you weren't going to say that, Alan.
No, that's not to say I don't fancy them to win, but it just doesn't work like that. And to be fair to England, I asked the question on Wednesday night because I was really, I suppose, really sceptical about the fact that You can't go through a tournament playing like England have played and expect to win the tournament. At some point, they have to put in a performance. And in fairness to them, in the semi-final, they did play really, really well. Interestingly enough, the only reason I think they played really, really well is because the Netherlands scored early and they're very reactive, England. They don't come out from the outset and take the game to the teams and try and blow teams away, like what we've seen maybe with the Spanish, who were all guns blazing for a minute one, and obviously they're trying to impose themselves on the opposition and letting their talent take over and their technical ability, and that's why they create chances and score goals and do all the things that we've seen them doing. England are obviously, all for all the things we discussed in terms of how cautious the manager is, a little bit conservative in the team selection, and what we've seen in the games has been all the evidence pointing towards that. Yet as soon as they go a goal down, they flip and bang, then all the talent comes out, the shackles come off, they go for the game, they create chances, all their big players start wanting the ball, wanting to create chances. So it'll be interesting to see if Spain score the first goal. That's what England will come out and obviously do, because I don't think England will go at it from the start. I think it'll be something similar from what we've seen in the tournament so far from them. But surely
you can't be reactive to this Spanish team.
No, I think they will, Shane, because I don't think they'll be so fearful of going from the game from minute one that they'll get picked off. And I think that's what we've seen throughout the whole tournament. It was a different, I suppose, the game against the Netherlands, where they always probably felt they were the favourites. So even if they felt as though they went a goal down, they wouldn't have obviously wanted to go a goal down so early. But I actually think that helped them. But I just think going into this game where they'll be seen as the underdogs, obviously France or Spain are the red hot favourites. I just think that it'll be more of the same in terms of the caution that we've seen in the tournament so far. And that could get them over the line. It really could, in terms of extra time, penalties. We could be in for a long night. I would fancy Spain, I have to say, because they've been brilliant. But I just think, off the back of England's performance, the first one that we've seen really against the Netherlands, that will give them real good hope going into the game as well.
Are England clicking at the right time, Fergal?
Not really. I think kind of when you look at tournament performances, particularly in the Euros, and everyone always kind of harks back to Greece when they did it, and they did it in a very specific way of being defensively resolute, nicking a goal, sitting back and just holding and holding. England obviously don't do that to that extent, nor can they really, because there is still as much as there's a kind of message from England at the moment now, which is there's been a huge amount of revisionism, let's be honest, from the end of the group stages through the knockouts, from England fans changing their stance on Southgate and how England have performed. They're not in a position really to kind of go either way, and I think, to kind of build on what Alan said, that shows that they're kind of stuck. I don't necessarily think they'll be fearful going into the final, but they'll be very, very, very cautious. Southgate is a naturally cautious manager. Quite a few of the players themselves we've seen in the tournament have gone for this idea of play it safe, we've got enough attacking quality to nick a goal, let's just play that as our strong hand. That doesn't work against Spain. And I think this idea of kind of fate and England fans thinking that the name is written on the trophy, in order to have moments in games, you need to play against a side that allows you to have those moments. Slovakia and Switzerland were not the favourites in those games. They were happy to just wait and see if they got the opportunity. And the Netherlands, who did well to get to the semis, also allowed England to have that opportunity. Other than a few set pieces, they didn't really have that many chances in the second half. The Netherlands, I mean. Tactically, Ronald Koeman changed a few things, and that made it harder for England. So many times in this tournament, we've seen England be posed with a problem, and they kind of panic and then eventually just muddle their way through and something happens and they get through to the next round. When you play against the top teams at club level or international level, they don't give you that opportunity. That's not to say that Spain will be 3-0 up at half time or something like that. Could happen. But Spain have shown so many different sides to them. They can mix it when they need to. They can be defensive when they need to. They can react to a setback. They can take a lead and hold on to a lead. They've got so many different ways they can manage different scenarios and different situations in games. England have shown themselves to only really have one card to play, which is stay in the game and wait for something to happen late on. Wait for something to happen late on. That can happen, but generally the best teams don't let that happen. The best teams decide their own destiny. They're not reactive to situations, they're proactive to situations.
Well, Ollie Watkins certainly defined a late moment for England. Alan, has he done enough to start?
He won't start, no. Southgate won't change the team. The only thing he might do, I think he might start Luke Shaw. I definitely think he's in with a chance of starting because...
Well, I would hope so. He brought him and he hasn't played the fact for the
that he's
final.
Got, yeah, the fact that he's got the minutes into him now, I definitely think he's in a position to start because they're so imbalanced. Trippier's done okay and he's one of those lads, I suppose, Trippier, good, honest professional, that a manager's dream. If you ask him to play in goals, he play in goals. But in terms of his quality, he's obviously he's not a left full, to be fair to him. He's a right full. So he's filled the void. He's filled the gap. He's done okay. They've got through it without him. But now they're in a position where, as Fergal says, you're going against the best team in the competition. You need to have obviously a left-sided player on that side as well, plus the fact that you're playing against one of the hottest properties in world football at the moment, and he's only 16, he'll be 17 by the time the final starts, but which will be a big challenge for Shaw. But I just think for the balance of the team, they need Shaw to start on that left hand side. That'll be the only change I think that they'll make. Kane will definitely start. There's not a chance in a million years that he's going to leave Kane out in the final if he hasn't left him out up to now. So I think Ollie Watkins will be waiting in the wings as well, again like Cole Palmer, like all the exciting talent that they have. But he's not going to start him from the off, definitely not. It'll be that cautious, cagey stuff. I think what Fergal said, and he's right in terms of the best team, Spain play like a team. England play it with the individuals that, and that's what's got them through, is that moments of brilliance from those brilliant individuals. We've yet to see them really perform as a cohesive unit, if you like. I thought the first half the other night they were very, very good. The best have played. Young Maina has been outstanding. And when you think Southgate, it took him three goals at playing three different midfielders before he actually chose Maina. It tells you where his head is at, Southgate, because that should have been sticking out like a sore thumb, really, that Maina was ideal to play alongside Rice. Yet he wanted to try Trent. He wanted to try Conor Gallagher. So I think he's been absolutely brilliant, young man, who won't face him in the final as well. So I think it's set up lovely, Shane. I think it's a better final with England in it, because I don't think the Netherlands would have put it up there. I think they're average. The Netherlands beat Romania and Turkey to get there. Spain have gone to hard. We obviously beaten Germany, France. I think Germany were probably the second best team in the tournament. So this is the first time England as well, on the back of the poor performances that we've seen, that they've faced top quality opposition. So they're going to have to really improve things massively from where they're at. Even though they improved it against the Netherlands, they're going to have to go up another couple of levels against Spain, Shane. So that'll be the big question. Can they do that? If they can, they're in with a good chance. And again, you have the moments of brilliance from the individuals. If they can't, Spain will beat them.
Fergal, on the point Alan was making, particularly about Kobbie Mainoo as well, how decisive will the midfield battle be? That kind of quadrant of Rodri, Fabian Ruiz, Dani Olmo against the likes of Declan Rice, Kobbie Mainoo?
Massive. There's so much attention from a Spanish perspective on Lamine Yamal and Nico Williams on the other side, but that matchup in midfield, I think, will be a concern for England, because generally speaking, since Gareth Southgate's changed the structure of the team, it's been Maynard and Rice in deep positions with Saka and Trippier or potentially Luke Shaw as kind of wing backs. That says to me that they're going to be outnumbered. Now, Phil Foden and Jude Bellingham are kind of playing as right sided and left sided number 10, so they will be there to help out. Whereas, again, I just think it goes back to the same thing that we've talked about throughout the tournament, planning. Spain have a plan of how they're going to do things. We're all quite clear on how they're going to do it. Luis de la Fuente, the players, will be quite clear on how they're going to do it. I still don't think Southgate and the players are absolutely clear on how they're going to set up for a game. And even more importantly, how they're going to change and react if things are not going their way. That's what happened against the Netherlands. Ronald Koeman got them in at half-time. They were still level. Made a few changes, got Nathan Ake nice and tight on Bukayo Saka, and he was completely nullified. Phil Foden dropped off in the second half as well. Players and managers in the Spain team, players and manager even, know how to react and change in the midfield, in certain areas of the pitch. England don't. And I look at that midfield, Rodri's got so much experience, so much control. Fabian Ruiz has surprised me a wee bit, because I kind of, based on his PSG form, I thought he was a good player, but maybe not at the level that he's demonstrated in the tournament. Pedri's injury was a big blow, and they've got Dani Olmo, which is that rare kind of mix of a midfielder that gets you goals but will work his socks off. He'll get back and help out. He links up really well with Yamal as well, so it's a difficult one for England, because I think centrally they've struggled, with the exception of Maynard. I'd agree with Alan completely, he's been excellent. Rice has had a few difficult moments. He got the ball pinched off him for the Netherlands goal by Xavi Simons. Jude Bellingham, aside from the goals, has looked tired and a bit off-key. Phil Foden's had some good moments, but it's not been a consistent tournament for him. Whereas all of those Spain players have been at least 7.5 to 8 out of 10 every game. That's not been the case for England. And to kind of go right the way back to answer your question, right in the middle of that pitch, Foden or Bellingham need to take responsibility to get back in and help when Spain have possession, because if they get outnumbered, Ruiz or Olmo will get free and they'll break on England, and that'll be a big problem for them.
Alan, I know in the past we've been talking about young talents, and from an Irish perspective, I'm always very hesitant to put too much pressure on the likes of Evan Ferguson saying he can't carry the team. However, I'm throwing all those rules out now by saying, can Lamine Yamal just decide this final?
Well, he's already proved the chin, so all those question marks and those kind of, I suppose, where you're thinking, I can't put too much pressure on a young kid, you can put as much pressure as you want.
I feel like he'd be all right.
I think he's backing it up.
I don't think he's going to be too concerned with my opinion either now, mind you.
And as I said to you here the other night, just in terms of, obviously, the talent gets you there and the ability, but it's the maturity that he's shown and the composure, and that's what's sticking out for me. And even more so, his decision-making at that level of football, Shane. When you're watching a game on the telly, they all look as though they've loads of time on the ball, and it's 100 mile an hour. You don't get a minute, you don't get a second at that elite level. And when you think of him being able to control the ball, come inside, pick a pass, always make the right decision more often than not, 8-9 times out of 10, at 16 years of age, playing against the best players in the world and with the best players in the world, it's a scary thought, really. And I suppose it just goes to show the level of intelligence that that young lad has as well, not just in terms of his football and ability, but what's upstairs, because it's outrageous what he's doing at the moment. And good luck to him, and I hope he has a great final. And the more I talk about this and the more we hear from Fergal and all the questions you're posing, Shane, there can only be one winner, because you're gone through the
nailed on for an England win, Alan.
But even in terms of you relax now, Austin.
I'm on the bandwagon.
But even in terms of the midfield area there, when you talk about Rodri and Fabian Ruiz and obviously Olmo as well, like, that's so much better than what England have also. Rodri, the best midfielder in the world in that position, so you can't see any of them laying a glove on him also. So then defensively, I think Laporte doesn't probably get enough credit, but he was unbelievable in the semi-final. Absolutely brilliant. Cucurella, who I always think is a bit rash, a bit mad, if you like, on that left wing back position, he's been absolutely brilliant, so he has, for Spain in this tournament. And then you're into the attacking options. Even Morata, to be fair, has worked really hard throughout the tournament. May not have got the goals and got the credit that the wingers are getting, but he's worked really, really hard, and he's been a good focal point for them. So I just think the more we, all the stats, all the evidence we've seen so far, everything is pointing towards a Spain win, Shane. And I think that's the way we should all be kind of gearing towards as well. England have obviously unbelievable individuals, and you're hoping one of them is going to step up with another moment like we've seen from Bellingham, obviously Saka, but kind of keep just pulling it out of the bag. I don't think so. I think Spain are going to win it.
Every time you pose that about Kante, that Mick McCarthy clip just keeps going around the head of.
Well, of course they can. But I don't know. I asked during the week, can they come up with a performance? To be fair, they did. I thought, but the Netherlands weren't up to much. They really weren't. I thought they were very poor throughout the tournament. Yeah. Covered a couple of the games. Even then, they played Romania, who were dreadful in that last 16 game, and then Turkey, who were decent enough. Turkey in the tournament, but Netherlands obviously came through that. When you think of what Spain are dismantling, they're not even kind of grinding their way through, they're dismantling the best teams in the world and come through so comfortably. For me, there's only going to be one winner.
Austin, you can double invoice now. I'm leaning on you again as the performance coach as opposed to the GA expert here as well. But just on Lamine Yamal that we were chatting about there at the start of that answer, really. I always think, particularly when it's European football players, that even when you're playing in the Champions League youth leagues and everything, you're playing in front of big crowds, so they might be more accustomed to the occasion. Now listen, it's not an occasion of a Euro 2024 final or playing in Camp Nou or anything like that, but young players coming through seem to be able to carry the weight on their shoulders.
Yeah, look, it's really interesting, and I had thought about this during the week as well, and I think there's a lot in this from the perspective that young players are now, there's a really good scaffolding being put around them in terms of, from a mental skills perspective as well, in terms of around concentration, focus, composure, all of these things. And I think there are things that are worked on through the academy systems and they're getting a lot more exposure to it, because as you pointed out, Alan, I know you said during the week as well, like, whatever about the technical skill and the ability, but the ability to execute in those key moments and the composure that he's shown and his ability to, you know, he's like, you're always looking at the decision making capability of a youngster. He's making it, you know, he's nailing it every time. Every time, like, he doesn't put a foot wrong. So I think for me it goes back to that level of what's being put around them, and these guys are heavily invested, I would say, from a sports psych point of view and from a mental skills point of view, that they're getting exposure at this stuff at a really young age as well. Now obviously the fact that he's gifted as well,
Of course, that gets him there originally, but that's what takes over for me. And another thing I think should be pointed out, and it's not a criticism of England and Ireland or whatever, but obviously this is where we live and we focus so much on the English game and that's what we see on our doorstep every week, but there's a humility about those foreign lads as well, and particularly Lamal, that maybe the hype, that now maybe we're not seeing it, maybe in Spain they're going bananas for him, but I don't think they heap the pressure on him. The way, look at Bellingham coming into this tournament, the whole weight of England was literally on his shoulders, and I think that's affected him, you know, because the hype goes into overdrive with him. And even you were talking there about Evan Ferguson, obviously, and we're always trying to dampen it down maybe, because you can get carried away and they're only kids at the end of the day, whereas I don't think you see that with the Spanish. I even remember Xavi and Iniesta, these best players in the world that we've ever seen, and they were always so humble, and there was a humility about them no matter what they were doing, no matter what they were achieving. And I think that's definitely helping them all as well, because I don't think they're heaping the pressure on him the way they would if he was English.
Okay. Gents, our football conversation for now is coming to a close. We will be previewing the League of Ireland this evening and indeed continuing our build up to England-Ireland. Fergal, before I let you go though, Alan, we had Alan Colley's thoughts on Wednesday when the Irish manager was announced. So perhaps a fresh opinion, a fresh voice in it. Do you feel that Hamer Hallgrímsson will be a success for the Republic of Ireland?
I think he ticks a really important box, which is winning games and putting Ireland in a position to qualify for major tournaments, and it was clear that that was one of the main things that he brought up in his first press conference, and he brings that type of experience with him. I know there'll be some looking at this from a perspective of, is it a kind of row backwards towards more pragmatic football and kind of more structured just to get over the line and get into tournaments regardless of how they get there. But I just think that particularly the last 12 months has shown the level has dropped individually, collectively, and there needs to be a freshness brought about these things. And he's experienced in the sense that it's not just going to be a case of, we do it my way, ultra defensive, try and nick a goal, and that's how we qualify for tournaments. He's a modern coach in terms of a lot of the things that he tries to deploy on his players. And it is what is needed. It's with all due respect to John O'Shea and some of the other names that have been mentioned, they just don't have any experience. And that is something that has been lacking in the last couple of years. So I think he will improve things. Obviously, he's got a difficult first game against England in September. He himself said he thinks England are going to win, so he disagrees with me and Alan. But I think it will be... Well, exactly. I think it's overall a step forward. But more importantly, it's a necessary step, because the situation just could not have continued as it had been.
OK, Fergal, we will leave the conversation there. I assume are you going for a Spanish win on Sunday, Fergal?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Austin, Spain or England?
Well, they say success leaves clues, and I think all the clues are pointing towards Spain.
I'm not even going to ask you, Alan Colley. You've already made your point. Fergal, thank you. Austin, we're going to be chatting at Gaelic football after the break. Alan, you're sticking around. Maeve de Burke will be joining us a little later on as well. Stick with us. Lots more to come here in Game On.
RTE
2FM.
Game On.
Gaelic football.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On. We are with you all the way until 10 o'clock, an international football special bringing you live coverage of England versus Ireland in the Women's Euro 2025 qualifier live at Carrow Road later on this evening. We will be chatting racing, rugby, cycling, League of Ireland, all to come, but we are chatting Gaelic football now because it is a feast of football this weekend. Two cracking semi-finals to look forward to, and indeed a Tailteann Cup final as well, Austin O'Malley. Let us begin our conversation Saturday, 5:30, Kerry versus Armagh. Peter Canavan actually was on the RTGA podcast and said Armagh have the strongest panel, perhaps not the strongest starting 15 when they're coming up against Kerry, but the strongest panel. They're really well managed. Is this a case of Armagh being rewarded with persevering somewhat with Kieran McGeaney?
I think so, and I think it's probably a trait of Kieran McGeaney. Even if you watched him when he, you know, in his own career, you know, in terms of with that old Armagh team, like they persevered till they got, you know, till they climbed the mountain and so on. So I think it's a characteristic, and I think it's, you know, the fact that they are such a resilient bunch, and it's stood them in good stead. I think Peter is right in terms of the panel they've built and what he's getting, the reward of that he's getting off the bench now. When you see the likes of Oisin O'Neill, you know, Stephen Campbell coming in, Duffy, Nugent, Ross McQuillan, they've all had huge impacts, and I would not be surprised, you know, again this weekend, that it'll be kind of become a battle of, shall we say, the backbenchers when Kerry decide to unload theirs as well. But definitely Armagh have a lot going for them in this. It's a brilliant opportunity for them. It's, you know, it's 19 years since they were last in a semi-final.
I could not believe that.
Yeah,
such a long wait.
It's such a long wait when you think, you think from yourself, so where do those years go? It's kind of scary.
I don't want to think about it.
Neither do I. But
perhaps I was purposely being shocked by the
yeah, so like these opportunities, they come around, you know. So like, you just wonder, are they ready to really grasp it? I think on the balance of it, you know, looking at their performance against Roscommon, I thought there were still gaps in it. I'm still not fully convinced. I think they are playing a lot of good football and stuff, but I still think there's. You know, they could play a little bit more fluent in terms of getting the ball quicker up front and so on. But I think, you know, you guys were talking in the Euros there about it being a cagey and a cautious affair. I think this game, Kerry and Armagh, will be really cagey, really cautious, early doors. I could foresee Armagh sitting in, you know, dropping their big numbers and really trying to soak up a bit of Kerry pressure early on.
Please don't tell me we're going to have Kerry Derry 2.0.
I think the template is there.
And oh,
like,
no.
Yeah, even though Armagh are probably they're a better defensive structure than Derry. I think they're at a higher pitch in terms of what they bring in. That watching them, like the amount of turnovers that they can get, they can transition quite quickly then. But I think like Kieran McGeaney would be very, very happy if he was given the scenario with maybe 50 minutes on the clock that it's a kind of a tie game or there's very little in it and he can unload a bench then. And I suppose on the flip side of that then, when you look at Kerry, they've kind of sat this exam already with Derry, even though that I think Armagh are probably a little bit higher level. So they have altered their approach in terms of, like Jack O'Connor said after the game, that like if you think you can come out and play gung-ho football against a system like Derry's with their ultra defensive, you're not living in the real world. So I think Kerry have altered their approach, and it serves them. They can now play in a way that, you know, that they probe, they're cautious, they're not just looking to go on the front foot and hit Clifford and the guys early, that they're going to probe. But I suppose for me, I just cannot see maybe the two Cliffords and Sean O'Shea being as quiet this weekend coming as they were in the quarter final, and I think that might just tip the balance.
But have teams not learned how to deal with them a bit better? They are generational talents. We were talking about Lamine Yamal before the break. Like, yeah. David Clifford is one of the greatest already to ever play the game. Likewise, Sean O'Shea isn't far off it as well. But even Mead, I think this year, they came out and they kind of had a game plan to try and suffocate those players in particular.
Yeah, and it all probably stems back to, in terms of just the numbers that they're dropping around back in front of them, and teams are getting so skilled now at getting what we call double ups and triple ups on guys and that. But I still think in this game, like the longer it'll go on when the space does open up, that those guys are they're your killers. They will get space. I have a feeling, you know, I just have a feeling that David Clifford and Paddy again and Sean O'Shea, I just think that they're going to bring a level. I'd say they would probably, reflecting on the Derry prompt, they would be disappointed in terms of maybe the levels they hit in that. So I think that you know, if they catch fire, I think it could just tip the balance. But I would not be surprised, and this is not me sitting on the fence, that this thing goes to extra time and we could see penalties as well. That's if Armagh sit deep and they snuff out space and they kill the Kerry Kings, this thing could go right down to the wire. But if Armagh come out and play and have to come out and play and leave space at the back, I could see Kerry edging it, you know.
I completely see where you're coming from with that somewhat edginess as well. But from Kerry, are you concerned with their form? Like, I mean, even they lost last year's All-Ireland final. Jack O'Connor, they don't do it two in a row. They're surely going to be coming out like demons almost here to say, no, listen, we need to get into the final, and then that's the final hurdle then to get over that line as well, but to get there.
to get there for Kerry. Yeah, look, it's a massive one. And I think, again, like when you look down and like probably everybody was tipping early doors, there was going to be a Kerry Dublin final again. And I think even the fact that Dublin not being there now, that, you know, this will really have kind of pricked the ears of Kerry again. And I think they'll be looking at this going like, this, there's a huge opportunity here that, you know, if we can get over our ma, that and get back into another final, they'd really, really fancy themselves given what's on the other side of the draw as well. So absolutely, like, but you cannot discredit what Armagh have done, the resilience that they've shown. You know they've suffered a lot of heartache, and you know, when you look through that Armagh setup again and you look at the likes of the form of Conor Turbutt, Rian O'Neill, Rory Grugan, they have a huge amount of quality in that team, and all these guys are playing really well. Like, I would say Conor Turbutt at the moment is a shoe-in for an all-star. Rian O'Neill going really well, even their midfield in Grimley and Creeley, they're all adding. And you know, we can't talk about Armagh not mention the season Oisín Conaghty, a wing forward, is having as well. So they've a lot going for them there. But as I said at the outset there, I just think Kerry, given the artillery and the bit more gelignite maybe up top, that they get across the line.
Okay, so Kerry might get across the line on Saturday. On Sunday, 4 o'clock, Donegal, Galway. Is this genuinely a 50-50 call? Is this going to be an open game of football, or how do you see it play now?
I think it's this one is so tight again, you know.
Is there any open games of football in Gaelic now?
That's a great question. I'm coming at this with a glass half full.
He is.
I don't mean to be disparaging, I love Gaelic as well, but it is like you're talking there about even Clifford, a generational talent. But if he was in a different era, and I'm not saying you should set up eras for individuals, but if he was in a different era where it was 1v1, like, he'd be running amok. You mentioned there about doubling up, trebling. It's easier when you have 10, 12, 14 fellas behind the ball to double up and treble up, isn't it?
100%. And that's the way the game has gone. And like watching the game, like, you know, I was down in Kerry, you know, on holidays only there last week, and you'd overhear some of the conversations going, Jesus, you know, this is where the game has gone. It's not enjoyable to watch and so on and that. But fortunately, that's where it's at. That's the style that people have seen, that look, you know, they're not coming out playing this expansive brand of football where you leave huge space and these guys just carve you open in. So it's gone very, very, you know, I suppose heavily defensive in terms of most teams now are dropping, you know, 12 and 13 behind the ball, soaking up pressure, looking to play a bit, then counter-attacking out into the space if they can. So it's the only way that they look to probably shackle these real, as you say, generational players. And that's unfortunately where we're at the minute, you know.
Speaking of open football, how does Jim McGuinness, Donegal 2.0, differ from the successful group he created before?
I think it is different. I think they're committing an awful lot more bodies forward. Like, they're scoring heavy, even though, like, we probably look back and think of Jimmy as being the sort of the king of setting up ultra defensive and stacking numbers and that. I think this time they're committing an awful lot of more bodies forward on their transitions. They're getting a lot more people ahead of the ball, and they're also attacking that sort of centre channeler, that D area, a lot more. A lot of their scores are coming from around that, even though they get guys inside as well. Again, I think they're probably one of the best conditioned teams in the country. When you just look at the way they're finishing games, their energy level, they're relentless, they're runners from deep and that. And I think on the balance of it, that could be the difference on Sunday. Donegal's ability to stay in games and just that running power and that they have and that relentless sort of energy that they seem to have, a huge wellspring. And I know, look, it's almost an urban legend at the moment in terms of McGuinness's sort of pre-season training and that. And you know, when you weigh up all things considered, and you just think maybe the season Galway has had, and it's been so fractured with a lot of different guys injured and out, missing big blocks of training and that, these are all little one percenters that come into the balance towards the close end of the season. And if you look at the sort of the trajectory of Donegal, you're always looking at them from early doors. They've lost very few players through injuries or soft tissues injuries, which always gives you an inkling that they're a very, very robust, fit and healthy squad. So, you know, you're always looking at things, which tips the balance. Those are the things, like, even when you look at Shane Walsh, the blocks of training, maybe that he's missed. Damien Comer has missed, like, McDade is only back in. Paul Kelly still isn't right. These are the small things, but that's notwithstanding. I mean, the football goal we played to beat Dublin that second half was, you know, sensational stuff. And on paper, when you look through it, you would say Galway perceivably have the better footballers in many respects, but I just think that with the Jim McGuinness factor, he will come with a strategy and a game plan. You know, if you watch Jimmy, the way he sets his teams up, he will go out to nullify Galway's threats. So he will definitely have a detail. Brendan McCool will probably go and try and suffocate Comer, as he's done with a huge amount of players this, like he's done it to McGuigan, he's done it to Canavan, he's done it to a lot of good guys. So I just think that in the balance of, you know, Galway will have the artillery and so on, but I just think Donegal, in terms of the strategy and the game plan, and the relentless running power and that energy that they bring and the belief that they have in themselves in terms under Jimmy McGuinness will be enough to shade it.
Speaking of belief, and if I put that question to you about Galway, because we've seen in the past when teams topple Dublin perhaps in the most recent past, or favourites in a competition, that they feel like they've won the competition already, but that hasn't the case. It's only a quarterfinals, but Pádraig Joyson, that Galway group, he'll have them grounded and reset.
He will, and he needs to, because, you know, watching, I suppose, and Pádraig even said afterwards himself, you know, I think he probably had a sort of a reflective moment between the end of the game and when he done his interview, and he said, you know, I know that we got a little bit carried away out there afterwards in terms of the celebration and that. And look, that's important as well, but sometimes it is very hard to, you know, you get that huge release. I've seen it happen with Mayo maybe in the past, beating Dublin that time, that huge release of emotion. You know, you beat the All-Ireland champions and so on, and sometimes it's very hard to sort of, you know, come back down and climatise yourself and sort of, you know, repack away all that emotion again and try and channel your energy and raise again for another display and that. So, like, Pádraig Joyce's, he's been on the road a long time as a player, so he'll understand that very well. And I'd say that was one of the first things, probably the Sunday or the Monday morning, in terms of the recovery sessions, that would have been factored in, that listen lads, there's nothing won here, we need to get back to brass tacks again, and this is a completely different challenge that's in front of us again. And it's, you know, look at, you know he will know the Jim McGuinness psychology very, very well as well, in terms of they've played quite a lot of football at Sigerson level together. And, you know, I suppose there's, you know, he'd brought Jim McGuinness in for a train session in Galway only 2 years ago, so there's that bit in it as well. So Galway will be under no illusion in terms of what's coming down the tracks to them.
I think that's a great subplot as well, the two, because
I love to be in their heads,
because they're two elite figures for me in GA. McGuinness is obviously, the name speaks for himself, but Pádraig Joyce was one of my favourites growing up as a player, unbelievable quality player, and now obviously carrying it on into management. And I go back to Austin, we were here months back, I was at the Sligo game, and Sligo should have beat them. Last 100%. Kick in a game, and there was Galway fans. Now I don't know how true this is, but there was Galway fans next to me saying, "This is it, Joyce will be gone." You know, it was real doom and gloom. And they got out of jail the last kick of the game. They got a goal, and the whole thing has turned around. And here to find themselves in a position now to go on and maybe win an All Ireland.
Yeah, and it's so funny how things can change like that. You know, they definitely bottomed out that day, and they just managed to find something. You know, it was heartbreaking.
They were beaten all day by the last kick. Sligo,
a sliding doors moment.
Yeah, unbelievable. It was
absolutely. And, you know, seasons can change on such small things like that. But going back to your form, like, you know, again, as a subplot, just those two guys, and, you know, they were two incredible competitors themselves. You know, even if you think of what Pádraig Joyce done back in that, was the 2001 final, like 10 points.
Yeah, Joyce was class.
He was just an incredible footballer, like, and McGuinness, the character that he is as well. But it's just, like, it's leading into being a brilliant, brilliant game. It'll be such a game of cat and mouse. But, like, we probably haven't mentioned the factor, and it'll be a big one, that, you know, how fit and ready is Shane Walsh? He limped off in the last game. And, like, you know, when you look at, you know, some of the key moments, and games are all about big moments, like within that Dublin game, you know, it still came back to Shane Walsh, you know, with those key moments to keep them in the game, clipping those scores, those couple from play that he hit. So you just wonder if he's going to be right. I don't know if it's a hamstring injury. Anyone that has experienced that knows that, like, it's one of the,
you don't recover
ones,
too quickly from that.
Yeah, like, even though the way things are gone now, guys are getting back quicker, but you just wonder if he's not at full tilt. You know, it definitely will blunt in that front six of Galway.
If I have to push you for a prediction on this one, because I don't want to get your thoughts on the Tailteann Cup final as well, who will prevail?
I'm just going on the balance of it, putting everything into the mix with what I've said there. I think I just go for Donegal in terms of what I've mentioned there. That the Jim McGuinness factor, conditioning, the relentless, the energy, the belief that's there, and I just know that he'll have these guys wired, I'd say.
Okay, so you're going for a Kerry-Donegal final, in the All-Ireland final, that is, in the Tailteann Cup final, 3 p.m. Saturday, Laois versus Down. A lot of people tipping Down to prevail in this one. Would you agree with a lot of people, Austin O'Malley?
I'm not known for agreeing with a lot of people, but this time I'll go with it. No, I'd have to, again, I suppose I said at the outset, look, success leaves clues and all those bits and pieces. I think Down are probably further down the line in terms of their development and where they've come from under Conor Laverty. And I just think, you know, he's on a bit of a mission in Down in terms of to try and change the whole sort of culture within Down and Down football. And he's putting a lot of, I suppose, pressure on players to step up and lead. And he's gone in and he's tried to change, as I said, the whole culture, you know, the whole thing around standards and that. And he's been vocal about that, saying that maybe previous Down players in the past didn't expect and demand enough of themselves. So I think they're at a higher level than Laois. If you watched the two semi-finals of the Tailteann Cup, I think the Antrim and Laois game, it was a good game, but the immediate switch over when you watched the Down and Sligo game, I thought it was played at a higher intensity. There was a lot more physicality in it, and I thought that it just looked at a higher pitch. That's not to take away, I think Laois have been superb all year, and I think the job Justin McNulty has done is incredible. Like, and when you look at some, like, Laois have some really, really gifted footballers. When you look at the likes of Evan O'Carroll, Owen Lowry, Mark Barry, they're all playing really, really well. And even the former Brian Byrne, who's back from that serious injury, who weighed in with two goals versus Antrim, you know, so they're in a really, really good spot. I just think in terms of, as I said, you know, where Down have come from, they've lost one last year. I think they're on the road, they're a little bit more battle hardened, so I could see them getting over the line. But Laois will test them, but I just think, given the trajectories, I've said that they'll do enough to get across the line. But I suppose you're just looking again at, you're hoping that it'll be a real quality game.
Will it though? Because it's been a quality Tailteann Cup.
It has been. I think so. And even as I said, there the two semi-finals, I thought Laois played some amazing football, some real good kicking football, like where they were moving the ball through the foot, real good angles of plays, guys coming off kicking some beautiful, beautiful scores. And as I said, they've a number of standout players. And I think a guy that's worth mentioning from a Laois perspective is the likes of Mark Timmins. He's been around for so long, and the service he's given to Laois football, like, and you know, just to see him still going out there. And they've that young guy as well. There's a young guy, just James Kelly. I thought he's had a really massive season. He's been, you know, just literally, you know, surging up from the back, you know, transitioning ball and that. So, like, I hope it is a really, really good open game of football. But the way Down kind of set up, they will sit in again. They'll press, you know, they'll sit in, they'll absorb pressure, and then they'll counter really, really, really quickly. But it should be, like, hopefully, as I said, that we get a really, really good game. But I'm just leaning towards, I think Down probably, given where they are, will edge it.
Okay, great stuff. It's good to see you haven't quite gotten over that Sligo defeat to Galway, Alan Collins.
I still haven't. No. And even worse was the Tailteann Cup one against Down. We've had a bad year, Shane. We've had a good year.
Sligo have made huge progress.
Yeah,
I think,
unbelievable. Yeah, they were so unfortunate. We're so close. It was probably that day at Markovic Park. It was probably the best day I've seen Sligo have in a long, long time.
Yeah, no,
you know, they played brilliant
under
against Galway.
They've really developed and really progressed. I think
are they on the right trajectory?
They absolutely are. I think they're doing an awful lot of right stuff, and, like, you know, they've a brilliant under 20 team there that was very successful, and they haven't actually unloaded all those guys into the stream yet either. There's only one or two of them, you know, came in off the bench the last day, that young Canis Mulligan, I think, and these guys. So, like, they're doing an awful lot of right stuff in Sligo, and I think they're really going in the right direction. Yeah, and they'll fancy themselves to challenge, I think, next year for in Connacht again.
Yes. Will the likes of Sligo, and I'm not just saying it because we're getting into a deep dive in Sligo football here now, but for the likes of Down and Laois, considering the standard of the Tailteann Cup this year, that it can be a springboard. I know that's the reason it's there. Damien Lawler was on about talking about a third tier competition that perhaps the GA might be bringing in as well, but this can be used as a proper springboard into All-Ireland football.
I think so, yeah, and it prolongs your season as well, so you're getting more connection between guys and getting more reps into guys and that as well. So I think it without a doubt it has served that purpose, and there's been some cracking games throughout it, you know. And the final again, you know, you'd hope, as we said, that we get a really good game. But I think it has served its purpose when you see the development of the likes of, you know, Laois coming on and Sligo coming on and Down, like, looking to use it as a springboard back into Sam Maguire as well in that.
Well, hopefully it is a springboard, and hopefully that Sligo Gaelic football for yourself, Alan.
I'll be in Markovitch Park again next year, don't worry.
Listen, Sligo Rovers. Sligo Rovers get a few results, they'll be in Europe. Who knows, Alan? Who knows?
We're on the up. We're back.
You're back.
Listen, gentlemen, we have to take an ad break. Austin O'Malley, thank you so much for previewing all of that. Alan, you are sticking around, as I keep mentioning. Maeve de Burke will be joining us shortly. We've racing, we've rugby, we've cycling. We've loads to come here between now and 10 o'clock. We're taking a short ad break, and then we're going to check in with the news desk.
RTE 2FM.
Game on.
Football.
Now we are chatting football briefly. Well, we will be chatting it in detail later because we have live coverage of England versus Ireland in the Euro 2025 qualifier at Carrow Road. And there is team news in from the Republic of Ireland camp, so we can cross live to Norwich. Tony O'Donoghue, you have team news for us.
I certainly do, yeah. And Eileen Gleeson has caused maybe something of a surprise. There are five changes. Now, we knew some of them, of course, were going to happen because Katie McCabe, the captain, is suspended. Kira Caruso injured. But Louise Quinn, who would have made a record 120th appearance for Ireland, has been dropped, as has Megan Connolly. So the team is Brosnan in goal. A back three, we think, of Patton, Hayes and Niamh Fahey. She comes in for her first involvement in this league campaign. Wing backs Mannion and Jess Zhu. We think Mannion will be on the right and Zhu on the left. Midfield then of Lily Ag, Rusha Littlejohn and the returning Denise O'Sullivan. And up front, Amber Barrett and Emily Murphy. So that's where we're hoping the firepower and the goals are going to come. But you can imagine it'll be, a backs against the wall for against an England team, a very talented England team. Now, they were going to be missing a star player for them in Lauren James. She's injured. But they've got such strength and depth. In goal, which was one of the issues for them, Mary Earps hasn't returned. Hannah Hampton retains her place in goal. And there starts for Maya Letizia, Alex Greenwood and Georgia Stanway. So a very talented England team up against an unusual Irish lineup, you'd have to say. But try to not concede or to concede as few goals as possible will probably be the mantra, because the last I checked that Austria were 3-1 up against Poland. What we need to be is to not concede as many goals as Poland in order to get the seeded position for the playoffs, which will take place next week. So at the moment, that's looking okay, provided we don't concede five goals or more.
Tony, just before I do let you go, while I have you, you mentioned the amount of changes and perhaps the unusual starting 11. Will the cohesion be there to perhaps ensure that this won't be all one-way traffic?
Well, it's hard to tell that one because, you know, the week has been a strange one. Obviously, a lot of the players had come into camp in time to watch the programme on the allegations of inappropriate behaviour towards women players in the past. And that was just one aspect of a strange week because there was no media day then, having to travel to England. There wasn't that much time with this team on the training pitch. And then there were a lot of other distractions, you might say. Even some people were suggesting that naming the manager was a bit unfortunate, not giving respect to this team, because they're the ones with a chance of making it to the European Championship finals. They're the ones with a chance. You know, they've just qualified for the first ever World Cup last year. So I'm not sure how much time they've had on the pitch to work on this, but the experience of Fahey will help. But since the World Cup, the likes of Mannion, Patton, Hayes, they've all come in. It's a new lineup, really, over a short period of time. So that will be a key question, whether they can gel tonight. I imagine they'll do a lot of their defending this evening. And one thing I noticed, obviously, Serena Weidman was aware of it as well, the threat of the long throw from Megan Campbell. Now, she doesn't start, but of course, she is on the bench. And one thing I've noticed at Carrow Road, it's very, very tight. The space between the touchlines and the advertising hoardings is as small as you can possibly imagine. So it'll be difficult to get quite a good deal of purchase on the throws if indeed Megan Connolly comes into the fray at some stage. And it's something that Serena Weidman, the England manager, was very aware of, something they said they'd worked on as well, because she said that trajectory is more dangerous than a corner. We shall see. The rain is still coming down here in Norwich, but the crowd are coming in. Atmosphere is building. It should be a cracker. England versus the Republic of Ireland. Kickoff is at 8 o'clock.
Tony O'Donoghue, thank you so much for that. We are going to cross to Jane Mangan, who is at Newmarket, because all eyes on the July Cup sprint this weekend. However, before we look ahead, let us reflect on today, Jane, because you were there to see Dunica O'Brien win today's feature race.
I was, and Tony's getting the rain. Thankfully, it's dry here in Newmarket. It was a very pleasant day on the track, and I think Porta Fortuna read the script. Dunica O'Brien's filly was a Group 1 winning juvenile last year. She was a very good second in the Newmarket 1000 Guineas before winning the coronation at Ascot. So by far and away, she had the best form, the standout piece of form. For the first time today, she was ridden by Ryan Moore, and she made it look very straightforward. They looked like they went an honest gallop. Running Lion, as predicted under the Kerry man, Oisin Murphy, made the running, but this filly had a turn of foot that nobody in the Falmouth Stakes could answer. And she's now kind of established herself as one of the best three-year-old fillies of her generation. And it'll be interesting to see when she does take on the colt over the mile how she fares. But she's trained down in Cashel, and a win of a Group 1 at Newmarket is hard to come by. So well done to Team Dunica O'Brien.
Very much so. I mentioned at the start of our conversation there, the July Cup sprint is what really the weekend centres around. So what should we be most looking forward to?
Definitely. Look, it's a 12-runner sprint, which for a sprint is probably a small runner field. And it should be pretty straightforward tactically. Ina Sheeran is the horse coming out of Royal Ascot as the Commonwealth Cup winner. And he won the Sandy Lane Stakes a couple of months ago, beating the then hot favourite Van Dijk. Van Dijk hasn't run since he missed Ascot, and now he's on a bit of a reputation retrieval mission for Simon Crisford and James Doyle, but he was last year's crack juvenile. So it's being painted as a bit of a match between the pair of them. I think Regional, a horse called Regional, is overpriced, but I'm also interested in Aidan O'Brien's contender River Tiber, who was a very good juvenile last year. They tried him in the Guineas. Personally, I don't know if he really stayed in the Irish Guineas. And back to 6 furlongs, he could be interesting because Aidan has form doing this. The horse called 10 Sovereigns, who he ran in the Guineas, and he dropped him back to 6 furlongs and he ended up winning the July Cup. So it looks like on the market that we, as a country, don't stand much of a chance of bringing this prize home. But I think if Ina Sheeran weren't to win, it may well be a surprise that might go the way of River Tiber.
Okay, great stuff. We'll leave the conversation there for now. Jane Mangan, thanks so much for taking the call. There is a domestic racing, of course, this evening, Kilbeggan and Dundalk, Navan and Wexford tomorrow. But Jane, at Newmarket, thank you so much for that. We're taking a short break, and then up next, Bernard Jackman will be previewing South Africa versus Ireland in that second test match tomorrow.
RTE 2FM.
Game on.
Rugby.
Now, Bernard Jackman is with us to chat rugby as we look forward to South Africa versus Ireland in that second test tomorrow. Bernard, are you confident Ireland can right the wrongs of these small margins that culminated in the defeat last week?
I'm kind of on the fence, Shane. I thought last week was going to be the harder of the two games, obviously at altitude. All that spice and build up from a South African point of view, Loftus, and we, like, it was a bizarre game because we didn't play very well, but yet we could have snuck it at the end. And I think the box will be wondering how they didn't put that game out of sight. Obviously Andre Pollard missed some kicks, which is unlike him, but they still made the game, or let the game become a contest. And Razzie Rasmus admitted he was relieved at the end, and not, theoretically this week should be easier, although having said that, losing the likes of Dan Sheen and Bundy Aki and Craig Casey, who had a very good game, is a bit of a blow for Ireland. But it's still very hard to... I think it's going to be... We have a better chance of winning, but it's still hard to see us winning because I just think that impact from the bench that the Box have, which we saw last weekend. Razzie Erasmus has picked their most experienced team ever. It's incredibly strong. And there's still that feeling that Ireland are running on empty a little bit. So, I'm certainly not confident. But I know we could win it if we can play a little bit better than we played last week, where I think Farrell would be very disappointed with how our attack really took a long time to get going. But when it did get going, it asked a lot of questions about South African defence.
What do we need to do then in particular? Is it a case of cohesion in attack, or what will be key in terms of decisive factors?
Well, look, I think if you look at what went wrong last week, I think we defended very naively. And to be fair to South Africa, they showed an ambition with the ball in hand that they haven't shown before. and double the amount of passes that they're making in World Cup games, and played to the wide channels early and got a lot of success from it. And we looked very narrow, and we looked like we were defending. Some of the players were defending like Leinster, and some of the players were defending like Ireland did. So, and that's probably natural enough given how much, many Leinster players play for Ireland. And you would expect the second week that to be better. As I said, attack-wise, we didn't really get into our flow. Played long periods without the ball, which isn't like Ireland under Andy Farrell. So he'll feel, you know, shore up our defence, get a little bit more width on our defensive line, not give them those edges so easily. And then, obviously, let's see what we can do with ball in hand. And then the last part of the problem was when they brought on their six forwards, the scrum turned and they got a penalty try and another penalty with on an Irish put in. And that's, you know, if that happens again, we won't win. So they're the three areas for me that will be, you know, occupying the mind of the players and the management this week.
In terms of the changes, and I know you kind of touched on it there, some are obviously enforced with injury, some perhaps might be seen as tactical tweaks. How will that change the approach overall from an Irish perspective?
Well, look, the talking point, Shane, is obviously Peter Mahoney. Farrell has dropped his captain, who moves on to the bench, to be fair, but that's a big statement, you know. And in fairness to Pete, his form hadn't been brilliant in the Six Nations, but yet he captained Ireland to a Six Nations, so that's he's huge credit in the bank for that. But probably for Munster since the Six Nations, his form has only been okay, I would say, and just coming off around the 50 minute mark in a lot of games. But Farrell gave him the start, but I think he realised how physical the box were, and probably for Pete, over the last 6 months, he hasn't been having those big moments that he's had for most of his career, either in a Munster or an Ireland jersey. So that allows James Ryan to get a start and allows Ty Byrne to get back playing the six, where he probably can have more big moments, particularly in the breakdown area and bringing that physicality that Ireland will need to match from the box. And then you have Ryan Baird to come off the bench. So that's a big call, obviously. Ireland will potentially lose a little bit line-out wise, defensive line-out in particular, but obviously maybe gain a little bit attacking line-outs with Ty Byrne and James Ryan being taller men. And then, yeah, that's it. That's really the big one for me. And I think the huge question marks around our sub-props ability to come on and match what the box do. That was an area that last week would have really frustrated Ireland. So I'm really looking forward to seeing if we can find the answer to that this week.
How much, both on and off the pitch as well, during the match and in the build-up perhaps in the couple of days before, would the fact that Andy Farrell dropped his captain have on the wider group?
Well, look at it. I suppose it's a sign of Farrell has a very strong reputation for, you know, being a sort of nice guy, and he is a nice guy, but he's also not afraid to make the big calls. And I think that's just a reminder to all the players that, you know, present form is absolutely crucial. And this is the last game that these players are going to play under Andy Farrell for a year. Obviously, he's the Lions coach, so a big performance here in South Africa, away from home, when they're tired, when there's every reason to have the excuse, will go another long way towards, I suppose, giving themselves a better chance of playing on the Lions tour next year, British and Irish Lions to Australia. But more importantly, it gives him a chance to win a test match against South Africa. And Farrell has gone to South Africa with his best team with a view to winning a series. That can't happen, but we can draw it now. We can get a big win. It'd be a massive win for Ireland if you get a win tomorrow. So, yeah, I think it's a timely reminder that, you know, there's no passengers in this Irish team. And if you're not on form, whether you're captain or whether you've got 100 caps, your place is not guaranteed.
So when it's all said and done, Bernard, if it was the push here for prediction?
Yeah, I think South Africa by more than 7 points.
Oh, on that negative note, Bernard Jackman, thank you very much for taking the call. South Africa, Ireland tomorrow. There will be coverage on RT Radio 1 Saturday Sport. We're taking a short break and then Shane Stokes joins us to give us an update on the Tour de France.
Game on 2FM.
Now we are turning our attention to cycling, and Shane Stokes of the Velo website joins us to update us on the Tour de France. Today's stage went away of Belgium's Jasper Philipsen after a dramatic crash as riders sprinted for the line, Shane.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The Tour, I mean, there hasn't been as many crashes as previous years, which is something to be thankful about, but there was a nasty crash in the finale. Sprints are just really dangerous, and you've got a load of riders trying to get into very small gaps. Several riders came down, but Jasper Philipsen won the sprint ahead of Wout van Aert, and he himself came down in a crash a few days ago and seems to have recovered really well from that. So another sprint, and there's probably only one sprint left, so we're running out of opportunities for the sprinters.
And for Slovenia's Tadej Pogačar remains in the overall leader's yellow jersey, and it would seem he's going to be hard to catch.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because he's in the yellow jersey. He's a minute and six ahead of Remco Evenepoel. He's 1:14 ahead of Jonas Vingegaard. Vingo has won the last 2 years and beaten Pogačar both times, and was involved, as was Remco Evenepoel, in a really big crash on April 4th in a race in the Basque country. Vingegaard had fractured collarbone, fractured shoulder blade, fractured ribs, and a punctured lung. This is his first race since April, and he appears to be getting stronger as the race goes on, and there's a lot of climbing coming up. It's hard to say, because certainly Pogačar was the big favourite going into the race and would have been the big favourite up till a few days ago. I think he just needs to fight back, because Vingo did take a stage win ahead of him, I think it was 2 days ago now. That was a blow to Pogačar's morale. He really needs a big showing this weekend, I think, to get his confidence back and show Vingo that things won't necessarily go his way.
Well, that's good. We want that competitiveness at the top as well.
Yeah, sure.
One of the four main pre-race favourites, actually, Roglic, is out of the Tour after a crash suffered late on Thursday's Stage 12 yesterday. How disappointing is that?
It is very disappointing. Primoz Roglic, if you remember back to the 2020 Tour de France, which is the first one that Tadej Pogačar won, Roglic led for much of that race and went into the final time trial, which was the penultimate day, and actually was beaten by Pogačar and lost the yellow jersey. So it looked like he's been trying for many years. He's a former downhill ski jumper, believe it or not, took up cycling late. He's been trying for many years to win the Tour. Looked that year like he was going to win the Tour, and then had that kind of form collapse in that time trial, and had to come back to the race then the following year trying to win it again, and actually crashed out of the next two editions of the Tour. So he's had pretty rotten luck in the Tour in recent years, and really staked everything. He moved to a new team, to the Bora Hansgrohe team, which then brought Red Bull on board as a big sponsor. He moved the team to basically have the ability to completely target the Tour and not to be sharing leadership with anyone, and unfortunately has crashed out of the race. So it's very important, very disappointing for him, and there's many in the sport that I think just really want to see him have better luck, and that hasn't obviously happened this time around.
Shane, I do want to get your thoughts on the overall viewpoint from the Irish perspective, but nothing really of note today in terms of Ben Healy and Sam Bennett. They were pretty down the field.
Yeah, no, Ben Healy finished in the front group. So what happened today was this was supposed to be a day for the sprinters. That was the prediction. And Sam Bennett has been trying. You might remember he won two stages on the green jersey 4 years ago, and he's been trying to get back to that level. And today was the scene by his coach, Stephen Barrett, as the second last chance for him and for indeed, all the sprinters. So Sam Bennett had his hopes set on today. What happened was there was very strong crosswinds inside the final 60 kilometres. And Sam's teammate, Felix Gall, he started the day 22 seconds off 10th place. Gall got isolated and the team had to ride for him to get him back into position to finish with the leaders at the finish, to defend his chances of taking a top 10 finish overall. So Sam was unfortunately a little bit forgotten in that, just because the general classification, I guess, takes precedence. So he finished well back, having been caught out in the wind and having, he and the team having to ride for Felix Gall. So there's just one opportunity left for him out of eight that was in, you know, there was 8 opportunities at the start of the tour. So there's a stage to Nîmes on Tuesday, and really he's going to be putting everything on that. And he really does need a stage win because, as I said, it's been 4 years since he last rode the tour, an injury and illness, and non-selection have kept him out of the race since then. He really wants to get back to that level. Had high hopes going into this race, and I think to take a stage win before the race ends would be huge for him. So yeah, he's going to be going all out for Tuesday. And Ben Healy, he finished in the front group. He was sitting 14th overall, but with Primoz Roglic going out of the race, and then Jan Ayuso, who is a teammate of Tadej Pogačar, they were both, Primoz Roglic didn't start after his crash yesterday, and Jan Ayuso didn't finish because of COVID-19. So it means Ben Healy he's 14th overall. He had been 16th overall, and he's 5th in the best young rider competition. So he didn't target the general classification in this first tour, but he's, you know, inadvertently doing a really good ride for a tour debutant. He's still a very young rider, but he's going to be going all out for a stage win in the coming days. And he did tell me a few days ago that that is his priority over the general classification. So, yeah, I guess the big thing about Ben is, you know, the way he's riding, it's hugely encouraging for the future, and just shows the quality of just the extent of his ability, and that he could indeed target the general classification probably in 3 or 4 years.
Okay. Well, broadly speaking, that is hopeful and positive, and hopefully then, with the stages remaining, that it can continue in that, I suppose, hopeful and positive trajectory as well. What's to look forward to over the weekend then, Shane?
Yeah, so it's going to be really exciting because the tour until now, there's been some hilly stages, but the first summit finishes are actually happening Saturday and Sunday. So tomorrow's stage is to Pladay. I'm falling over my pronunciation. Pladay is tomorrow's finish, and then Plateau de Bay on Sunday. And they're two big summit finishes in the race. They're both Or category, which is the hardest climbs you can get. And that really sets the tone for this the final part of the tour. Next week, you've got that stage name on Tuesday after rest day Monday. And then you've got 3 other stages out of 4 stages that have summit finishes. So it's really changing the tone of the race. And, you know, whether it's Tadej Pogačar, whether it's Jonas Vingegaard, whether it's Remco Evenepoel, who are the top 3 overall, you know, whichever one of them is going to win will really make their form clear on those mountain stages. So yeah, it's really dramatic. It's the hardest finish of the tour I can remember. And there is a time trial on the final day, which is a very rare occurrence for it to be so late in the race, and that too has got some hills in it, and well, hopefully things will still be tight and therefore there'll be a really suspenseful end to the tour. But yeah, certainly the days ahead are going to be really dramatic.
Brilliant. Drama is exactly what we want. For now, Shane Stokes of the Velo website, thank you so much for taking the call. I'm sure we'll be checking in with you next week as the drama continues in the Tour de France. There's been drama in the Diamond League. Excellent drama and excellent news because Rashida Adeleke has secured a first Diamond League victory. She has won the 400 metre at the Monaco Diamond League with a time of 49.17 on the clock for the Tala athlete, who of course broke the Irish record in the 100 metre at the Nationals just 12 days ago. So a perfect dress rehearsal for Paris. So congratulations to Rashida. Kieran McGeehan, of course, is running this evening. The Morton Games are on as well in Santry. There's lots happening. Wimbledon, we haven't even mentioned Wimbledon. Defending Wimbledon champion Carlos Alcaraz has beaten Russian Daniel Medvedev in 4 sets to the Wimbledon final. Alcaraz will play either Novak Djokovic or Lorenzo Musetti. Djokovic is currently 2 sets up on the Italian Musetti and leads in the 3rd set by 3 games to 1. Elsewhere as well, we were chatting at rugby with Bernard Jacklin. Munster have confirmed that women's captain Doherty Wall will leave the province to join Exeter Chiefs. Wall made her first Munster appearance in 2019 against Connacht and captained the side in 2023. The 24-year-old has won 28 caps for Ireland and was a member of the side that qualified for the 2025 Women's Rugby World Cup. She also lined out with the Irish 7 squad. Wall spent the last 5 seasons playing in the Women's All-Ireland League for Blackrock College. We are going to continue our build-up to England versus Ireland in the Women's Euro 2025 qualifiers very shortly. We'll also preview this evening's League of Ireland Men's Premier Division matches as well. So lots to come. We are with you all the way until 10 o'clock. So stay with us. RTE 2
2FM. 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 2FM.